Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last time we were discussing, well, last time before our special programme on the late Queen, last time we were talking about Germany, we were discussing the weaknesses of the East German regime. But it needs to be said that the weaknesses of a regime, its economic inefficiency, its political oppression, does not mean that it is necessarily going to fail. Indeed, in many respects, the determination of those governing it, the self-styled elite, to hold on to power can make them ruthlessly determined to do so. East Germany was a basket case, but compared to Syria or North Korea today, it was in some respects an Elysian, and yet that did not mean that East Germany was going to succeed and that Syria and North Korea would fail. So in many senses, we have to look at the contingencies, and this is particularly so because previous pressure on Eastern European regimes to change, to democratize, had failed. One can think of East Germany in 1953, one can think of the Hungarian Rising, one can think of the Prague Spring, one could think of Solidarity. All of those had been crushed, often brutally crushed. And so therefore it wasn't by any means the case necessarily that in 1989, or for that matter, any other particular year, that the communist regimes of Eastern Europe would collapse. I think if one's looking for failure, one can look both at what was happening within East Germany and also at the policies within the Soviet Union of Mikhail Gorbachev, both the policies of change within the Soviet Union, glasnost and perestroika, which in a way intensified the East German regime's loss of legitimacy. And also, it has to be said, Gorbachev's attitude to developments in Eastern Europe. The active role of Soviet forces had been crucial in the case of the failure of reform in and pressure for reform in Prague and in Hungary. In the case of 1953, the Soviets had played a role. And in the case of Solidarity, in the suppression of Solidarity, they had actively threatened intervention in order to get the Polish army to act. So in a way, there was a style sheet, if one wants to use that term, and one can think of what happened in China in 1989, Tiananmen Square and elsewhere, there was a style sheet which would suggest that reform would fail. Now, in 1989, the pressures moved in different directions. It wasn't inevitable, and any historian that pretends that it was is failing. But I think it's certainly the case that if you look at both the policies of the East German government towards the pressure of reform and of the Soviet government towards the direction of change in Eastern Europe, neither of them failed adequately to appreciate the consequences of what was going on. In the case of the East German government, it failed to rise to the challenge set by Gorbachev's reform policies, of which Honecker, the East German head of state, was very critical, incidentally. And when they did come, promises of reform proved to be too little, too late, as indeed did the eventual change of government in East Germany. Indeed, by September 1989, significant pressures were building up within that country. East German society, to a degree, was dissolving as its citizens, especially the younger generation, left in large numbers and contemplated leaving in even more. Hungary's opening of its Austrian border had permitted substantial numbers of citizens to leave for West Germany via Hungary and Austria from August 1989. And that captures, as it were, the kind of concertina effect, or dominoes effect, if you wish to use that term, that one was to see in Eastern Europe. They were abandoning not only economic failure, but also what one, I think, can fairly see as the lack of modern civilization. If, as I do, you see modern civilization as entailing free expression, tolerance, opportunity, and cultural vitality, then communist societies simply did not possess it, and indeed still don't possess it. Hungary refused to heed pressure from East Germany to stem this tide of departures, and Gorbachev was unwilling to help. His renunciation of interference in other communist states was crucial. Indeed, in the first 9 months of the year, about 110,000 East Germans resettled in West Germany, while others took part in mass demonstrations, notably in Leipzig. Indeed, it's rather interesting in terms of pressures within East Germany that, to a degree, the fall of East Germany was a Saxon revolt against direction from Brandenburg, from Berlin. From the 4th of September, steadily larger numbers bravely and peacefully demonstrated in the Autumn Revolution, one in which the Protestant Church played a major role. And the call for German unity was strong within that movement, but so also was the call simply to change East Germany. Of course, an observer of all of this was Vladimir Putin, who was serving in the KGB in a quite senior position in East Germany. Now, as we know from China in 1989, there is nothing inevitable about the pressure for reform, which clearly existed there as well, necessarily leading to an outcome. Indeed, we have seen more recently over the last 20 years, pressure for reform suppressed in countries as various as Venezuela, Belarus, Myanmar, and Iran, and they by no means exhaust the list, all of which where there has been extensive democratic and would be democratic pressure, and all of which it's been brutally repressed. So in a way, what's interesting is why it didn't work out the same way in East Germany. Rather than explaining East Germany as if it's obvious, the norm, that a pressure for democracy should succeed and would succeed, we should turn that on its head and say why, in the situation in which state-directed sort of governmental machines operating in favor of a monopoly of power and doing so with considerable vigor, why in the absence of any democratic sort of position within the constitution, other than in terms of the words of the constitution, why did this lead to the direction East Germany took? Now, I think part of it is that there was a demoralization of supporters of the regime in terms of a sense of failure and emptiness. The kind of return of the exiles, the communists indoctrinated, fearfully so, under Stalin, which had been so important in the early generations of East Germany, was no longer pertinent. Moreover, West German consumerist democracy, epitomizing what, interestingly enough, the East Germans called the fetishism of things, not that it stopped them getting them. And as we know, for example, the North Korean dictator at the moment is very keen in seeking things like brandy from the West, proved far more attractive to the bulk of the population. Moreover, the repressive state seems to have no longer terrified. In part, it had suffered a massive failure of intelligence with a serious inability to understand developments, let alone to anticipate them. I mean, autocratic regimes classically suffer from confirmation bias. One's seen that with the Russian regime of Vladimir Putin and its reporting on what it thought was going to happen in Ukraine. And East Germany was a classic example. Nobody was going to secure and preserve their job if they reported upwards that there was large-scale disaffection. And all these intercepted letters and spying availed the Stasi naught. In addition, the situation was different to that faced East Germany in the disturbances of 1953 and 1961, because the regime no longer wished to rely on force. Partly because it was unwilling to compromise its reputation, partly because the old ruthlessness was no longer there. And anyway, the East German army was unwilling to act. Moreover, the nature of the demonstrations, both peaceful and lacking central leadership, lessened the opportunity for repression. If you want to repress something, you need the usual suspects to round up. To paraphrase Casablanca, if you haven't got the usual suspects, if there is a mass movement, you're in considerable difficulties. Although it's true that unfortunately a similar domestic scenario hadn't prevented the Chinese authorities cracking down earlier in the year and showing that could be done. Anyway, on the 16th of October 1989, in response to a situation that seemed and indeed was to be drifting out of control, Erich Honecker was deposed by his colleagues. In other words, they offered the public a new regime. But nevertheless, the new sort of Politburo remained under pressure from popular action, couldn't gain control of the situation, nor, and this is more significantly, create an impression of control. An impression of control is more significant than control. Most regimes don't really control what's going on within their country. They simply try to give an impression of control. As a result, on the 7th to the 8th of November, the entire government, all the ministers and the Politburo resigned. And on the 9th of November, the Berlin Wall was opened. Now, this was both an occasion and a symbol of falling of freedom. It was a totemic event, like the storming of the Bastille in 1789, and in a way, it was in a way overplayed. I mean, in a sense, the system had already collapsed. The fall of the Berlin Wall was the consequence, and people who claim to have played a crucial role in causing the Berlin Wall to fall are generally overplaying their own significance. Anyway, developments in East Germany invite counterfactuals, including what if the Hungarians had not opened their Austrian border, as well as the question of whether or not the East German system could have been stabilized by removing Honecker earlier and giving reformed communism a greater chance. Alternatively, if Gorbachev had been replaced, as indeed there wasn't to be an attempt to do so in the Soviet Union, could Chinese-style repression have worked in East Germany? And I think it's fair to say one's got to be careful about being confident that any particular option would not have had an effect. Anyway, for example, Hans Modrow, the Communist Party's first secretary in Dresden, had suppressed a demonstration in Dresden on the 4th to the 5th of October, arresting 1,300 people. But a key element is that Gorbachev was unwilling to pursue the repression that Khrushchev had employed against Hungary, and that helped to ensure governmental authority in East Germany collapsing. I mean, I suppose a modern example would be the crucial role of Putin in holding in place the regime, the Assad regime in Syria, and the crucial role of Cuban support, including Cuban secret police, in holding in place the regime in Venezuela. Honecker's successors failed to provide the reform from which they sought to ensure stability. And whilst there were people now moving in greater numbers into the West through the holes in the Berlin Wall, within East Germany itself, the pace of events was against the regime. The Stasi headquarters in Berlin was occupied by demonstrators in January 1990, and communist one-party rule was followed by multi-party politics. Where that would lead to was as yet unclear, but I think we can pause now and sort of discuss the points arising from the actual fall of, as it were, the authority of the East German regime.
Well, thank you, Professor Black. I'm very interested by the question you set out, which is why did these events happen? Why did they succeed in East Germany? You pointed out that reform had been blocked and indeed suppressed, crushed in other countries, most recently, obviously, at that time in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. I wonder if just take a two or one step back from that and see how we see the movement towards radical reform in East Germany is distinct from other Eastern European countries. I mean, a key moment is obviously, as you identified, the opening of Hungary's border with Austria, through which East Germans could find themselves passing. But would you say the attempt to reform in East Germany came after that in other Eastern Bloc countries, or was it going at roughly the same pace? To what extent was the Honecker and then Krenn's leadership in East Germany caught out by the speed of reform and indeed disintegration of communist rule in other Eastern European countries?
I think that's a really interesting question. I would say that it moved at varied paces. I would say Hungary was at the front and Romania at the back. That's in Eastern Europe. And you have exactly the same range or variation if you think about the constituent republics within the Soviet Union, which technically was a federation, and where these republics were themselves to get independent, some of them being more forthright in their demands for it, the Baltics, for example, than others were. So I think you wouldn't expect necessarily a common pace. East Germany was fairly unusual. I mean, in one respect, it was unique because it was the only country where a process of unification with another country, to wit West Germany, was possible. I mean, nobody was going to have Hungary rejoin Austria to create a new Austro-Hungarian state. But in the case of East Germany, there was always this prospect or possibility of unification with West Germany, and linked to that, the question of what that entailed and also what measures might be necessary within East Germany, either by maintaining existing processes or by embracing certain reforms to cut short any such possibility. So I would say that East Germany moves on a different trajectory, in part because there are several players, and one of the major players is the West German state. Another linked to that player, if you like, are those groups' tendencies within East Germany that are seeking not just change in East Germany, but unification with West Germany. And that is, I would say, a very different matter. And that leads to, of course, the somewhat confusing events of 1990. And the point about it also is it poses a very different issue as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, because the Soviet Union It poses a very different issue as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, because the Soviet Union could fairly argue that the division of Germany was a crucial aspect of the post-war settlement. It could argue that it was crucial to its security. It could argue that it only wanted or was willing to accept unification of the two parts of Germany if there were guarantees about West German policy, or sorry, the new German state's policy, and specifically that it shouldn't join NATO. So in other words, there was an element of potential for Soviet intervention, irrespective of the Soviet Union's view on the fall of communism in East Germany. And that, for example, was very different to Soviet security concerns about, shall we say, Bulgaria or Hungary, which were very, very different and where there was no equivalent. And of course, the Soviet Union was in a position to express its views because in Eastern Europe, the largest location of Soviet forces were in East Germany. There were a lot of them, and they were of considerable lethality. Whereas in some Eastern European states, Romania, for example, there were no Soviet troops at all. So I think to that extent, you are on a different trajectory. What is interesting is you do not have a linkage between Soviet policy and anti-reform politicians. The linkage you were to have seen, you had seen in Hungary in 56, you had seen in Poland, you had seen in Czechoslovakia, but you have nothing like that. And that, I think, is interesting. I am sure that if Gorbachev had been so minded, they could have scratched together a East German cohort of leaders, communist leaders, to call for Soviet action against what they would have called, you know, Western revisionists who were linked to what they would have called fascist circles in the West, etc., etc. But they didn't. And that, I think, is an instance of the significance of Gorbachev, that there is no sign that he set out on what would have been for Western Europe a very difficult process if there had been the suppression of popular demonstrations in East Germany. That would have put a lot of pressure on the West German government. Although what we already had seen in the case of Poland and in the case of Hungary and the Czech Republic and in the previous case of demonstrations in East Germany is the Western powers were not willing to provoke a conflict with the East, which still obviously had an enormous amount of nuclear lethality.
Clearly, I mean, as you say, the role of Gorbachev is central to this. What's not clear to me is we look at it now with the hindsight of knowing that Gorbachev had decided not to intervene militarily and not even to encourage military intervention. But what do we know, either through the archives, of what the East German government knew about Gorbachev's intentions in the second half of 1989? Did they have clarity that this was his line? And as a secondary question, the people on the streets in Dresden or Leipzig or East Berlin, to what extent did they know that Gorbachev had decided that there wasn't going to be an intervention? Or did they just feel it in their bones that the more they protested, the more they weren't shot down, the greater the confidence they had? But it wasn't based on anything other than just immediate experience.
Well, Gorbachev had already announced that he was not going to intervene in the domestic affairs of East German states. So to that extent, the East German regime knew what the situation was. I mean, obviously, they could always hope that Gorbachev was overthrown. Communist modernizers, if you wish to use that term, had not The previous one was Khrushchev, and Khrushchev had been overthrown in 1964. So there was no inherent reason that Gorbachev wouldn't follow the way of Khrushchev. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that Gorbachev himself, you know, he had, as I've mentioned, views along the lines I've already referred to. So, for example, in February 1990, Modrow, who was the chairman of the Council of Ministers from November 89 to April 1990, and who tried to delay reform and unification, he unveiled, under what he felt was a way to try and cut short reform pressure, he unveiled a plan for what he called a German-German confederation as part of, quote, a united fatherland. Now, what that would have meant is unclear, but what it clearly was intended to mean was that East Germany would remain a separate state following its own destiny, presumably under communist control. Now, what Gorbachev responded to Modrow was that a unified Germany was acceptable to the Soviet Union only if it was demilitarized and neutral, which incidentally, you know, that's Gorbachev taking up Stalin's line after World War II. You know, that Germany needs to be demilitarized and neutral. That had been a Stalin line. The Americans were unwilling to accept the Soviet proposal for the mutual withdrawal of troops from Germany. So in many senses, it's not just that Gorbachev is an important outside player, but so is George H.W. Bush, and of course, Margaret Thatcher and François Mitterrand. Again, it's interesting, I mean, you know, as to what the scenario would have been if you'd had weaker Western leaders and they'd been willing to go along with some sort of proposal to neutralize Germany, and what message that would have sent. But of course, the determination of Western leaders, and here again, it's one of the many instances in which Margaret Thatcher played a very important and positive role in history. You know, there is a tendency among a lot of people to be critical of her. In fact, she was extremely perceptive in her understanding of what was going on. And she was worried about a united Germany. There's no two ways about it. But she also understood very clearly that a neutralization of Germany would serve Soviet intentions. And she was very clear that she needed to press Bush against that policy. Whereas I think it's fair to say that Mitterrand, as ever, you know, the Sphinx, as ever, followed a less helpful policy. Let's just put it like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very interested, as you discussed the West's response to the situation in East Germany, that you refer to George H.W. Bush, you refer to Margaret Thatcher, you refer to François Mitterrand. The other Western leader you haven't mentioned yet is Helmut Kohl. In Bonn, how significant was he actually in the shaping of the Western response? Or was he really, prisoner is not the right word, but was he essentially the passenger in a response which was shaped by primarily American Britain, but also France?
Well, I mean, Kohl had to operate within the context of possibilities, which of course is what politicians have to do. They can try and shape that context, but they can only go so far. He was helped enormously by the free elections held in East Germany on the 18th of March. East Germans weren't used to free elections, but they were held, and they demonstrated the lack of support for communism. The East German CDU, in other words, the equivalent of Kohl's political party, won 40.8% of the vote as part of an alliance for Germany that won 48% of the vote. The relaunched SPD won 21.9%. Now, what this signaled to Kohl is that if East Germany came into the system, into a united Germany, there was going to be apparently an enormous electoral boost for the CDU. Well, he would have been very odd not to have been interested in that. While the SED, the, if you like, the East German Communist Party, now renamed the Party of Democratic Socialism, a classic contradiction in terms, won only 16.4% of the vote. So what that showed is that not all of those who wanted to end East Germany had as it were, left. So the leader of the East German CDU was elected prime minister on the 12th of April by 265 to 108 votes with 9 abstentions, and he backed rapid unification. So that was very much put pressure on Kohl. Now, Kohl himself, he was determined in a way to see unification go through once it appeared a prospect. I think there's no doubt about that. Kohl was not somebody that liked to embrace failure. So once the situation changed in East Germany, and of course, currency unification with West Germany helped that, or it took effect on the 1st of July 1990, undermining the viability of separate East German companies. So once that took place, Kohl was very much, as it were, going with the swim and helping to ensure it. He was helped by his close relation with Mitterrand. What Kohl appears to have done, I mean, there was an enormous amount of corruption in the Franco-German relationship, is that French companies would be allowed to acquire East German state-owned companies in the rapid privatization that was pushed through at a cut price. And there was also movement of slush money around, that a lot of this money gained from the underpricing of assets was then used by Mitterrand, in particular through Elf, the big oil company, was then used by Mitterrand to bolster his own electoral interests in France. Interestingly enough, I mean, I'm not the first person to point this out. Interestingly enough, though, you find it very difficult to get, if you want to write that, to get it into the history books. So there was some opposition to unification. It existed in West Germany, notably from the Greens. But what Kohl wanted to do was to have the West German model made that of the basis of the new state. So that entailed the end of any prospect for an independent East Germany. So there's going to be no, for example, equivalent of Austria, but also any idea of a different former East Germany within a united Germany wasn't to take effect. So the citizens' movements, which had been seen in late 89 in East Germany, such as the New Forum, were not to serve as the genesis for a new vision of German society. On the other hand, these movements lacked the power of solidarity within Poland. So, you know, I think one can say that Kohl went with it. He helped to shape it. It helped him to win re-election as Chancellor of the now United Germany in 94. As you know, East Germany stopped being a separate state on the 3rd of October 90, and all German elections had followed on the 2nd of December 1990. And as a result, the 3rd of October was celebrated as a new national day of commemoration. But to a degree, and I think this is worth bearing in mind, to a degree, there was some celebration, considerable celebration in East Germany, but there were some circles who would have preferred a different outcome for East Germany, not a continuation of communism, but not being submerged into a West Germany as happened. So West Germany's flag and national anthem became that of the new state. There was a restitution of property in former East Germany. There was currency union meant cutting the value of East German savings, or that was how it worked out, which was a cause of anger in the former state. So there was bitterness. I mean, West Germans complained that they transferred funds in vast amount to the former East Germany in order to help see through unification, make it work. And they complained about East Germans being ungrateful. But as far as some East Germans were concerned, they were the equivalent of being colonized. You know, those people in many institutions were replaced by people from the West, and discontent in the former East Germany became much more pronounced from the 2000s, with a big rise not only in far left politics but also in far right political identity and activism. So, you know, you could argue this is ironic, as East Germans had benefited considerably from unification, but that didn't assuage a sense of discontent. And interestingly enough, that was particularly pronounced in Saxony, which was the very area that had been very angry with communism and which had played a key role in the public agitation against communism in 89.
Well, we'll discuss in the next episode how the reunification played out and the new tensions that it created. But I'm very keen just to really follow up from what you've been saying on that period in which what might have been a merger between East and West turned into an acquisition of the East by the West. In our kind of shorthand memory, we seem to, you know, we think about the fall of the Berlin Wall as if that was the moment of reunification. But as you say, of course, it wasn't. You know, that was, I think, right at the end of 1989. And then it wasn't until October the following year that the reunification took place. Do you see the effective acquisition of East Germany by the West as a near inevitable process, given the greater size of the West, the greater economic potency of the West, you know, the drift of money, and the sheer political bankruptcy of the pre-existing leadership in East Berlin. Or were there opportunities in which East Germany could have fashioned a stronger persona within a reunited Germany?
Well, again, that's a fascinating question. First of all, I think there is absolutely nothing inevitable in history apart from unpredictability.
Yeah.
So contingency is the only inevitability. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, a lot was dependent on the big powers. So Gorbachev had to accept that an American demand, that the American demand that a unified Germany be part of NATO, which was also the demand coming out from Margaret Thatcher. And it's not clear to me what would have happened if he'd rejected that. After all, there were a lot of Soviet troops in East Germany, and they remained there, as you may know, after 1990. It took a number of years for them to leave. It would have been very, very, very difficult to, as it were, ignore their presence if they'd not wanted to go. So that is an interesting perspective. You ask, so I mean, I'm not in favour of this idea, which you get so often from German historians and German commentators and historians of Germany, that the answers to German history are to be sought solely within Germany. I think that's ridiculous. And I think you need to understand the role of great power politics and how that played out in particular contexts. I think that's very important. And linked to that, I think, is the question of what would have happened if Gorbachev had gone, if he'd been replaced, if there'd been the equivalent within the Soviet Union of the consolidation of a regime seen in China in 1989, where, of course, there were changes at the top. That, I think, is significant. It doesn't mean necessarily that the Soviets would have put tanks on the street, but it might well have meant a different pace of developments in East Germany. Your essential question is, could a more efficient East Germany have worked? I don't know. I mean, as we have seen, you know, inefficient, cruel, incompetent, totalitarian communist states rumble on. Cuba, Venezuela. I mean, I know Venezuela has elections, but the results are pretty predictable. So there is no inherent reason to believe that the same could not have happened in all or various states of Eastern Europe. It would have been, though, very difficult to have maintained a communist East Germany once Poland had gone in a different direction, and once Czechoslovakia had gone in a different direction, Poland being the crucial one, because without Poland, there was no direct link between the Soviet Union and the Soviet forces in East Germany. Indeed, as you may know, I've written about this in my geopolitics book, but the Soviets in the 80s, in response to Solidarity, did develop ferry routes from the Soviet Union to the East German coast so that they shouldn't have to cross Poland. But I think the point is that although it is likely that the direction that was followed of a East German regime failing because it couldn't satisfy its citizenry would have been the one of note, nevertheless, in my mind, as I've said, there is nothing inevitable about the course of action in 1989 and 1990. And this raises questions about the broader nature of German history. And I regret to have to say this, but you cannot help asking whether the enormous and impressive energy and determination of so many East Germans in 1989, you cannot help asking whether if that had been replicated during the Third Reich, we would have had a very different trajectory for Nazi Germany. I don't know, and there are all sorts of counterfactuals, and the Nazi regime was more than willing to murder large numbers of its own citizens, whether or not they were Jewish. But the fact of the matter is, there was nothing comparable in Nazi Germany, and I think that is a real stain on German history. I think we should note that at the same time as we applaud the bravery and the desire for democracy of East Germans in 1989.
Well, that's a tantalizing question and also a sober point on which to end on. Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Short History of Germany, for talking us through the reunification of Germany. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.